Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event in conjunction with the Science and Technology Forum. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Kurt Beyer. Kurt is the author of Grace Hopper and the Invention of the Information Age. Kurt is a former professor at the United States Naval Academy and lectures regularly on the process of technological innovation. He's a co-founder of a digital media services company and has authored multiple patents pending on high-speed digital data processing. He currently works for Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, and he works with startups and entrepreneurs as a financial advisor. In addition to that, I found out this evening that Kurt grew up in Huntington, Long Island, which was very close to where I spent several summers many years ago as I was about to become a lawyer. So I'd like you to sit back and enjoy the background on how the information age started, especially the contributions of one woman. Thank you very much. Kurt?
Thank you, George. It's an honor to be able to speak tonight at the Commonwealth Club, and it's a special event tonight also for me in particular. This is a homecoming, and when I look out in the audience tonight, I see so many friends and family. So thank you to all of you for coming out tonight and supporting me. Some of you in the audience remember a time when this book was just an idea. That was many years ago now. That's about 8 years ago. And you also know how difficult it is to turn the idea into a published book. It's many hours spent in research, in archives, talking to archivists, doing interviews, because you need to reconstruct the past. You need to reconstruct not only the lives of the individuals that are in the book, but you also have to reconstruct the technologies that are in the book. What you don't know about the book is that the research only provides the skeleton for the book. How you fill in the flesh has far more to do with the author's own life experiences. So when I look out to some of you out there, you are embedded in the pages of this work. So when I was trying to think about how a woman like Grace Hopper survived in male-dominated environments, I turned to the women I know who were strong, successful women who work in male-dominated organizations, and I thought about their personality traits. When I had to write about the process of technological innovation, I thought about the many conversations I've had with people in this audience who have created technologies from scratch and who have worked in startups, as well as my own experiences. So I think it's only proper to thank all of you, because tonight is not just a celebration of Grace Hopper, but it's a celebration of your lives as well. Where do you start a book? That's a challenge for any writer. Where do you start the story? Well, it seems obvious if you're writing about the computer age. You start with the first computer. But that's not right. Because once there's the first computer, it meant that the forces that came into being to create the technology have already occurred. So this was the conundrum I had when I first started writing in 2003 and 2004. And it was an event that we all shared together which led me to the understanding of when the computer age begins. And the event we shared was September 11th. Think back on that day. All of us were involved all of us experienced it. And from that moment forward, we were all changed. On a macro level, the trajectory of the country was changed. Within 6 weeks of 9/11, we were at war. But think about how 9/11 changed you on a personal level. I can speak for myself, but I think this holds true for many of you as well. A crisis like 9/11 forces us to reevaluate our own lives and make new decisions. So too, the generation that experienced December 7th, 1941, were changed by that experience. So, on December 6th, Grace Hopper was a successful professor. She was married. They had a house in New York City. They had a summer house in upstate New York. And without December 7th, none of us would have known about her. But that event creates the crisis that drives the new technological innovation. On a macro level, the government starts funding exotic research projects. On a personal level, Grace Hopper, within 6 months, leaves her husband, quits her job, and starts trying to join the United States Navy at the age of 35. The problem was the United States Navy didn't know what to do with a 5'2", 105-pound PhD in mathematics. That all changed a year later when the WAVES program was formed. So Grace Hopper became one of the first women to become an active duty officer in the United States Navy. She assumed that she would be involved in efforts to break codes. But the Navy had something else in store for her. Let me tell you and read to you about her first day on active duty. Hopper reported to Aiken's Harvard command in the basement of Harvard University's Krupp Physics Laboratory on 2 July 1944. If being escorted down to the basement by an armed guard wasn't disquieting enough, the presence of her physically intimidating boss was. I was a little bewildered and at that point, of course, thoroughly scared, Hopper recalled. Years later, she distinctly remembered the first words uttered by Aiken. Where have you been? Aiken proceeded to give her new recruit a tour of the automated sequence-controlled calculator. All I could do was look at it. I couldn't think of anything to say at that point, she remembered. At the end of the tour, Aiken ordered his new assistant to put off finding a place to live for another day and to get to work immediately. Her first task was to compute the interpolation coefficients for the arctangent to an accuracy of 23 decimal places within a week. How would you like that to be your first day on the job? The machine she was looking at was 81 feet long, had 750,000 moving parts, and 520 miles of wiring. And she was the person in charge of it. And she was given a simple problem to solve that day for a PhD in mathematics. The only issue was the problem was impossible to solve. There weren't enough man hours to solve such a problem to such accuracy. Computers couldn't do it at the time. What was a computer in 1944? It was a person with a pencil and a piece of paper who would do calculations. That's how we did calculations in 1944. So what did Hopper do? She turned to the manual, right? There was no manual. This is the first computer. So over the next 3 months, she systematically starts to figure out how the machine was constructed and how she could make it work. Once she solved that and figured out how to do trajectories for the Navy, you would think her challenges had ended. Well, the Navy had such a backlog of difficult problems to solve that they kept on sending new types of problems to this machine. What they didn't understand was the machine was designed to do one thing, solve trajectories for ballistics. The most difficult problem that she faced in that first 6 months was one that was brought to her by a man named John von Neumann. Von Neumann was one of the world's eminent mathematicians. And the problem he brought her was to cause a sphere to implode upon itself. And he needed to know where to put the charges so that sphere imploded at an exact rate perfectly from all directions. It was a very difficult partial differential equation problem. And this was his last chance. Maybe this machine and this woman could solve it. For 4 months, she worked on this problem. She eventually solved it. Anyone know what that problem is? There you go. The implosion problem for the nuclear bomb. The Fat Man bomb, which was the first nuclear bomb successfully exploded, and then that was the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki, and 6 days later, the war ended. So as you can see, she was trying to solve some pretty complicated problems and important problems during the war. In that process, she invented a new field, the field of computer programming, because this machine, unlike any machine before it, had to become whatever you needed it to become. So prior to this moment, I would argue, when a technology was developed, it was developed with a single purpose. So you create a lawnmower and you mow lawns with it. You create a hammer, you hammer in nails. But what makes the computer so unique? It's the only technology which can change over and over and over again. I think Hopper would have loved the device I have in my pocket, and I do not work for Apple in any way. When I get up in the morning, I check my email, then I do a little texting, then I make a phone call, then I check the weather, then I check some stocks. The hardware isn't changing, right? It's the applications, it's the software that is the important part. So during the war, Hopper was faced with the problem of solving all different types of problems on a single piece of hardware. Now that work that she did for John von Neumann did not go unnoticed. For those of you who have worked in computer programming or engineering, know that the current computers we use today are built on what's called von Neumann architecture. Well, about 6 months after von Neumann worked with Grace Hopper, he wrote a paper called The First Draft, and it's considered the seminal work for computers. He talks about the stored program computer. And he distributes this paper, and about 2 years later, he tries to patent it. He tried to patent the computer. And it became a huge fight over who owns the rights for the computer. Thankfully for all of us, it was thrown out of court because he had distributed the original paper 2 years prior. So it was considered part of public domain by that point. In my story, I think I'm the first person to try to explain where von Neumann got the idea. And he got it from his work at the Harvard Computation Lab, working on that implosion problem. So how does the United States Navy reward one of its most important mathematicians and officers? A person that probably had more to do with how the war ended than most anyone else in the country. Well, they released her. They didn't need women in the Navy anymore once the war ended. Her boss, Howard Aiken, was named a full professor at Harvard, and he was put in charge of the Harvard Computation Laboratory. A few of the other people that worked there were also given full-time positions at Harvard. Grace Hopper could not be given a full-time position because Harvard didn't hire women full-time in those types of positions. So they offered her a two-year research gig, and she took that. And for the next 2 years, she continued to expand the foundation for programming. They came up with subroutines, branching, parity checks. And one of the most famous things she came up with during those 2 years happened on a summer night when they had to keep the windows open because there was no air conditioning at this point. And the Harvard Mark II, the second computer they worked on, stopped working one night. So the person who was in charge of the computer that night looked it over, found a moth stuck in one of the relays, taped it in the logbook, and wrote under it, "We've debugged the computer, and it seems to be working fine now." The pressures of the war and the challenge of not being allowed to allow your potential to become a reality eventually were too great for Hopper to handle. Let me read a little something. On a cold night in November 1949, only 6 months after leaving Harvard and joining the Eckhart and Malkey Computer Corporation, Grace Murray Hopper found herself behind bars at the Central Philadelphia Police Station. The programming pioneer was arrested at 3 a.m. for drunken disorderly conduct. She was eventually placed in the custody of Pennsylvania General Hospital for treatment. Hopper's life was unraveling. At the age of 43, she had accomplished much, yet her growing dependency on alcohol was jeopardizing her career and her relationships. As winter approached, she eventually attempted suicide by drowning herself. She's 43. She's divorced. She has no children. She can't work in the two institutions that she wants to work at. She joins the first computer startup company, the Eckhart and Malkey Corporation. 2 weeks after she joins, their senior investor dies in a plane crash. They're about to go under. Her life is unraveling. And she's an expert in an area that no one cares about. She had a lot of good friends that she made during the Harvard years. They were the people she was in charge of. And after they all left Harvard, they formed a group that today is known as the Association of Computing Machinery. It is made up of the original crew from Harvard. And it's that group that came to her assistance. I actually found an intervention letter from one of the group members, Edmund Berkeley. Let me read you a section from that. "I and many other people know full well what a wonderful intellectual and emotional endowment you have. Even when you function properly only 70% of the time, you are worth to Eckhart and Malkey Computer Corporation every penny of the $6,500 they pay you. I can see in my mind's eye the marvelous things that you could accomplish with the 30% of the rest of your time now wasted, such as writing, teaching, living, and any other of the other things at which you are so competent." This is 1949, and their assistance works. Eckhart and Malkey is saved by a typewriter and tabulating company called Remington Rand, and so they become a division of this new company. They call it the UNIVAC division. That's the new computer they're working on. Because she knew how to get a computer up and running, she became in charge of making the UNIVAC work. And life was actually pretty easy for her in 1950 and 1951 because no one wanted a UNIVAC computer. There wasn't much to do. That all changed during the presidential election that year. It was the first televised presidential election between Stevenson and Eisenhower, And someone at UNIVAC got the great idea to build a fake UNIVAC next to Walter Cronkite's desk during the televised election. They took a real UNIVAC and they gathered voting data from the years previously. And with 1% of the vote in, they wanted to see if the UNIVAC could predict the outcome. And the UNIVAC said that Eisenhower would win by a landslide, 491-89. The Roper polls and the Nielsen ratings all said it would be a close race. So Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America, lied to the American people and said that the UNIVAC said it's going to be a close race. Well, the results came in the next day. UNIVAC missed by one electoral vote with 1% of the vote in. Walter Cronkite got back on the air that night along with a representative from UNIVAC, and they announced the true results. And you can imagine the hair on the back of every organizational leader and corporate leader in the country. These machines can predict the future. We need to get one of these. And that creates the second crisis, the second technological crisis in Grace Hopper's life. Suddenly, there are 40 orders for these machines. They have the ability at that time to produce 6 to 12 a year. And every single order is to another company that has a completely different idea of how they're going to use the machine. So the insurance company wants to make actuarial tables. The engineering company wants to do engineering problems. And Hopper is the one that has to go company to company and design the software, figure out how to make the machine work for that company. And initially, she tries to do it with manpower. The problem is there's only a handful of programmers in the world now. Most of them have been trained by Grace Hopper. She solves the problem with technology. In 1952, at the Association of Computing Machinery annual meeting, she introduces the world to another seminal paper. It's called The Education of a Computer. In that paper, Hopper explains how a compiler, she coins the phrase compiler, can be used to allow the computer to program itself in part. And in that paper, she discusses how the human being can now talk in a language that they're familiar with. They don't have to write in machine code anymore. They can now write in English, German, French, numbers, equations. And the compiler would be the one that then translates it to machine code. The compiler could also take care of many of the administrative duties that at that time a programmer had to figure out. So she solves the problem through technology. But it doesn't stop there. One of the main points of the book is that it's not enough to invent a new technology. The inventor has to be able to sell it as well. So how did she do that? Well, the first thing she had to do is get a budget. So she went to management and said, "You have a real problem. You're going to lose a lot of money, because the costs of programming are now more expensive than the cost of the machines themselves. I have a way out of this. I call it automatic programming. I need a budget, I need personnel, and by the way, make me the director of automatic programming while you're at it." The way Grace Hopper broke glass ceilings was she invented the new jobs that she needed. They approved her budget. And in 1954, she is now the director of automatic programming at UNIVAC, probably the most important position in the division. She starts setting up seminars trying to teach the companies the benefits of automatic programming. She starts classes, pulling back on her academic career to teach a new generation of programmers how to program. And during this time also, they're inventing the first programming languages. The first one was called Mathematic. That eventually leads to one that most scientists and engineers in the room know, Fortran. The other one she works on is called Flowmatic. It's a business object-oriented language. And what I found when studying how Hopper organized for innovation was that she used a technique that I think goes against how we want or how we envision our inventors. We want them to be heroes. We want them to be geniuses. We want them to go into a basement, disappear for 2 years, and come upstairs and hand us the problem and say, I solved it for everyone. And that's why if you read some of the histories that have been written about Thomas Edison or Sperry or Tesla, it makes them out to be almost gods. But that's not how it works. And in fact, the way it works, I think, is far more difficult. Hopper constructed a network of compiler developers, and this was unique in a variety of ways. Whereas Howard Aiken had isolated the Harvard Computational Laboratory from other computer projects, Hopper realized that the process of invention could not be confined to the artificial boundaries of her staff or even her company. Information flowed smoothly between Remington Rand and other organizations, with Hopper serving as the conductor of invention rather than its dictator. Though she insisted that copies of all correspondence be passed through her, Hopper did this in order to better orchestrate the efforts of others rather than to control the direction of compiler development. What's more interesting about the network of innovators that she created was that most of them were women. And we like to think of the computer industry as a male-dominated industry. And all the movies we've seen about computer programmers usually have pimply teenage boys. When in fact, the reality during the 1950s, the most dominant group of programmers were women. And the matriarch of this group was Grace Hopper. She was the one organizing them. She was the one feeding them her vision of the future. And what was that vision? That vision was that computers must be democratized. We need to make them as easy as possible to use if we expect this technology to grow. And the way we're going to do that is with programming, and not just complicated programs that only PhDs in mathematics can understand. We're going to do it with programs that management can understand and that high school graduates can actually work on. That was the only way to expand the technology in her mind. The culmination of this vision occurs in 1959. At this time, she's still a member of the Navy. She stayed in the Naval Reserves. She was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania. And, of course, she was a pretty prominent businesswoman. So she pulled all those groups together. And she created a two-day conference, the CODASIL conference, in the spring of 1959. 7 government organizations, Department of Defense, the 10 main manufacturers of computers, the main users of computers at that time, they all sent representatives. And for 2 days, they brainstormed about what would be the perfect, ideal business programming language. And then she assigned a team to take those suggestions and develop the standards for the language. And just 50 years ago this month, That program was approved by Grace Hopper, since she was the head technology person of the committee, and it was named COBOL. The funny thing about COBOL, in 1959, 1960, when it came out, everyone hated it. It was terrible. The programmers didn't like it. The users didn't like it. The management didn't like it. It was verbose and wordy and too far away from the machine. So Hopper's next 7 years were spent selling again. The importance of selling the idea. What she understood was that if you ask a programmer what they think the best programming language will be, it will fail. If you ask a user what the best programming language will be, it will fail. A technology must have embedded in it the compromise between the different groups that are going to be using it. And that second best compromise isn't always the most logical technology, isn't always the prettiest technology, but it's the one that has the best chance of surviving. Hopper then goes on a 7-year tour pushing COBOL. She writes articles. She talks at conferences. She uses two other interesting techniques also to try to push COBOL. One was she invents a character. And this character will be the poster child for COBOL. As the 1950s came to a close, Sperry Rand's director of programming research, Grace Hopper, conducted an experiment to demonstrate how far the field of software development had advanced in the 15 years since she wrote her first code. Hopper would attempt to turn a trim, attractive blonde into a computer programmer. Hopper's subject, Marilyn Mealy, Marilyn Monroe, Marilyn Mealy, a 19-year-old high school student from the Mayfair section of Philadelphia, was prettier than average and liked to swim and listen to hi-fi records. According to Hopper, Marilyn was much like other young women who window shop during their lunch hours and look forward to an evening's dates and dancing. And she said, I'm going to turn Marilyn Mealy into a computer programmer in 6 weeks. And the very group that she created, the ACM, and the programming community thought she was insane. These machines are far too complex to entrust with a high school student, let alone a woman that looks like Marilyn Monroe. And sure enough, 6 weeks later, Marilyn Mealy was writing code. And she would use this case over and over and over again. Hopper had a tough streak in her also. You don't make it this far as a woman in a male-dominated world if you're not tough. So the other thing she did to help COBOL along was she went to her friends at Department of Defense, and she convinced them to make a statement to all the computer manufacturers that we will not buy any more computers if they do not have a COBOL compiler embedded in them. Being that Department of Defense was buying most of the computers at this time, that was a pretty good point of leverage against the IBMs and the Honeywells and the Raytheons of the day. Well, what happened to that language, COBOL? Today, 50 years later, 70% of all active code currently running is COBOL code. The Y2K issue was a COBOL issue. When they designed the program in the late 50s, they didn't think that they had to make the year a four-digit number. So you can imagine all the COBOL programmers from the 60s and 70s came out of retirement in the 90s. And they made a good amount of money during that period. Hopper's story doesn't end in 1967. She retires. She's given plenty of awards. She lived a full career. She's in her mid-60s. And my favorite award that she receives from the ACM is that they decide to name her the first man of the year. In 1971, the Nobel Prize for Computer Science is created, and it's called the Hopper Award. And many of the most prominent computer scientists from 1971 to the present, have won the Hopper Award. But Hopper wasn't done. She gets a call from the United States Navy. They're having problems integrating the new computer systems. So she signs on for 6 months. That 6 months turns into 20 years. She becomes the first woman to become an admiral in the U.S. Navy. I got to meet her my first year at the U.S. Naval Academy. She was this frail, old woman wearing an admiral's uniform. And I thought, who is this and how is she going to teach me anything? And then she stood up to the freshman class and she started painting a picture of a computer age that I couldn't even imagine. We were given our own computers, which was something shocking in the mid-80s, especially someone from Long Island. If you've seen Jersey Shore, you know what I'm talking about. We brought the computers up to our rooms. We plugged them into something called Ethernet. That was connected to MILNET. And on MILNET, we could actually run programs on other computers, interact with other computers. I could use something called email and write to my professors. I could look up my grades and schedule my classes, all from my computer in my room. When I went to medical and dental, my records were digitized. So when I went to flight school, they just pulled up my record. So you can imagine how shocked I was when I got out of the Navy and came here to Silicon Valley in 1997, and I met all these 25 and 30-year-olds who were telling me they're inventing the future. There's this thing called the Internet. It's so cool. And I thought back, wow, this old lady told me about this many years back. I want to end the talk with a few lessons that we all can apply from Grace Hopper's life. First, lead, do not manage. She used to have this saying that you manage things, you lead people. Let me give you a few examples of how she did that. First, she empowered youth. She had this strange tendency, anytime they were solving a complex issue, to assign it to the youngest and least experienced person. And her reasoning was that they didn't know that they should fail. And she didn't expect them to solve the problem, but she knew that they might approach it from a different angle. And then once she had some clues, she could then assign it to a more senior person. The second thing that she meant by lead, do not manage, is you have to give your team a vision of the future, a vision of what can be. The reason why I wrote this book and decided to make Hopper the main character is because most books about technology sometimes don't even mention people in them. I want to remind everyone that people create technology. And it's Hopper's vision of a computing future where many people can have access and use these machines, which was so unique. It didn't have to be that way. Computers could have remained scientific instruments very easily. The vast majority of programmers in the 1950s wanted it that way. because they would be the high priests of these machines. It was her vision of the future, and that vision that she told over and over and over again and convinced the people she was working with, which made the vision a reality. Lead, do not manage. A third trait that she had, which was quite unique, was that you need to learn at the margins. We like to call it thinking out of the box. The problem is none of us think out of the box. We don't. We become set in our own ways of thinking. We like to practice what we're good at. We like to associate with people who are like us, both politically and socioeconomically. But the problem is we're building an intellectual cage around ourselves when we do that. So how did Hopper break that cage? One thing I found that was fascinating was when she was a college professor, every semester she audited two classes that had nothing to do with mathematics. And they were as diverse as philosophy and politics and economics, architecture. So by understanding other fields, she could break through a bit of that intellectual bondage that surrounded her. And think about how that then applied to the concept of the general computer. She could walk into a company and within minutes figure out how to apply the technology to their needs because she knew something about their world. So that's one thing that we can all try to do. Try to learn things that aren't our strengths. The second thing she did was she was in multiple organizations and organizations that were very different from each other. So she had one foot in business. She always taught. She was always associated with the military. And each of those cultures and organizations are quite different. So that's another way she broke that intellectual bond, was to be associated with different people in different organizations. I think the final point I want to make about Grace Hopper is that she is a tremendous role model for us today. And what I mean by that is the reason we don't know about her, and we may know the name of Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or Larry Ellison, is that she never made much money doing any of this. When you're motivating people, stock options are one way to motivate them. Bonuses are another way. But helping them see a future that is better for all of us may be the best way to motivate people, because that's what motivated her during all those years. So as we go forward and we think about some of the incredible intellectual and technical problems that this country needs to solve for our generation, I hope that there are some Grace Hoppers out there that will help us do that. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Kurt, for that really, really illuminating talk. And now the audience has a chance to ask any questions they want to. Who wants to go first? Who wants to be the first Grace Hopper?
Anyone except for Brent Thill, please.
So I'm moving here to ask a question.
Okay, great. I mean, Mike, where did you get all the materials to reconstruct her life?
Most of them were found at the Smithsonian Institute. There's a computer history archive at University of Minnesota. Harvard holds the records from the Harvard Computation Laboratory. University of Pennsylvania has the records for the ENIAC and UNIVAC projects. So literally it was hours and hours of digging into all their papers. So imagine if someone just boxed up your home and put it in a bunch of boxes. And then I had to figure out who you are and what type of person you were and what you cared about and how you thought from that evidence. So that's pretty much how it was done.
How did Grace Hopper deal with competition between the companies she was working with in the early days? You were talking about the patent, and that was thrown out. But what with all these companies going, you know, I want to make the computer a different thing. How did she deal with that?
Sure. Part of that distributed innovation, she really didn't see the boundaries between her own company and the other companies. So she actually had people in those other companies working on these advanced programming and compiler systems with her. I actually argue that we sometimes think that open source programming is some new, interesting way of doing this, when in fact, I would argue that that's the norm. And then in 1969, after the antitrust case with IBM is settled, that's when software is decoupled from hardware, and we see the evolution of the software industry. And then IP around the code starts developing. I mean, the fact that Bill Gates becomes such a large player in this, it's no mistake that his dad was a lawyer. I think he put two and two together during those years. So for Grace Hopper, there wasn't even a thought that she shouldn't share this information with other people in other companies.
I have a question. If I take it that your meeting her was at least the start of your inspiration to work this long on the book. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you put in the time for this and what inspired you to do it? I mean, it's obviously a great story and an unknown one.
Sure, yeah. Definitely the way I found out about her was my experience in the Navy and the fact that she changed and affected my choices. I actually met her before that even. I went to my sister's graduation from William & Mary when I was 15 years old, and the commencement speaker was Grace Hopper. And that was kind of bizarre also because as she was being introduced, she was sitting next to the podium knitting. And I thought, again, what am I going to learn from this old person? And it shocked me again. She got up there. She had a very dynamic, powerful voice, commanding. And she's talking about this information age. And again, as a 15-year-old, I had no idea what she was talking about. I was used to having my grandmother talk about the past. So to see a grandmotherly figure talking about the future was somewhat of a shock.
And I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that we're listening to Kurt Beyer talk about his book, Grace Hopper, The Woman Who Invented the Information Age. Next question.
Pretend for a moment that you are UNIVAC and look into the future. Is the Grace Hopper open source model the way to go, or are we going to be locked into the fierce patent rivalry of wicked capitalists?
That is a loaded question.
Answer it deleting the word wicked and see if you
I think both models can exist, and both models have their merits, and both models have their shadow sides. So, I mean, there's no denying that packaged software that is protected through intellectual property has helped to change the world in a positive way. I also think that open source is growing as a viable option, and we've seen a lot of successes, especially in the area of Linux and some of the back-end B2B operating systems. Through open source. So my answer, I'm hedging myself, is that both are important going forward.
You mentioned that most of her programmers were women in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how she connected with that many women that were going to get involved with programming at that time, and what turned the tide away from that majority.
Sure. So when she went to the Eckhart and Malkley Corporation, there was a facility of computer programmers during the war at the University of Pennsylvania. So again, a computer during the war was a person with a pencil and a piece of paper. Most of these positions during the war were held by women. And so when Eckhart and Malkley, John Malkley, wanted to build a support staff for the UNIVAC and for the ENIAC before that, he actually drew from this group of computers. So that's how kind of the core formed. What I noticed was once Eckhart and Malkley was absorbed by Remington Rand, it now became part of an older male-dominated hierarchical structure. And many of those women didn't survive the first 2 or 3 years. For a variety of reasons, they decided to move on. Hopper didn't. And I had to try to understand, and that's what I meant at the very beginning, that I've been reflecting on the women who I've noticed who survive in male-dominated organizations. What are their characteristics? How do they do it? They're very competent. They're very good at what they do. In fact, oftentimes they're better than the men. But I've also seen the ability to play, meaning they have good senses of humor. Hopper, and there was a big debate over the book cover. If you notice and look closely, Hopper has a cigarette in her hand. We know she was a drinker. I've told you that already. She was a smoker also. She liked to party with the boys. She could hold her own, and she loved practical jokes. Aiken was horrified when she showed up as his number two in command. He was horrified that it was going to be a woman, and he let her know. After a few practical jokes on him to put him in his place, and the fact that she was the one who figured out how to work the machine, very hard to not have her in that position of authority. I think the real shift comes really with the decoupling of software from hardware and the monetization of software. You make something valuable, men flock to it pretty quickly, right? You keep it on the margins, there's a lot of women that are involved in those areas. So that's kind of my analysis.
Fortunately, now we have time for one more question.
Kurt, I like the story about UNIVAC and the first televised presidential election. That could be the first product placement we've seen. So she had a marketing sense. You mentioned it's not enough to invent, you have to sell. When you researched her, what were her inspirations? Who taught her how to be such a good sales/marketing person?
Yeah. She didn't come from a family of engineers. She came from a family of businessmen who were marketers and salesmen. And her grandfather, the one grandfather, was the president of a major insurance company. And when she was actually home for Christmas leave in the winter of 44 and talking about this new machine with her father and grandfather, they were the ones who were like, wow, these could be used in the insurance industry. So she even says, there's a quote in the book that says, it was actually my father who was the first one to realize that these machines could be used well beyond just being used as a scientific tool. So I think she gets that sense from her family. On another side note, her other grandfather was a Navy admiral. So now you see the connection with the Navy.
I think there's just enough time for sneak one more in. were there any women in her history, in her family, or that she used as a model, or did she invent the role all by herself?
I think she invented it all by herself. One thing I did notice, though, that her father and mother were very supportive of her education. So she was the first woman to get a PhD in mathematics from Yale University. And that was done at a time when most women weren't going to college. So I think she has to thank the fact that her family was very open-minded and wanted her to have the same education as her brother.
Thank you very much, Kurt.
Thank you.
And thank you to the audience, and as well as those listening on the radio or online. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.